When you're preoccupied with something that's nagging at you psychologically or emotionally, there is less you have left over to be putting toward what really matters to you, your work, your career, your training.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who cannot stand whipped cream, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 92 of the Running for Real podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode. I am really excited to have you. If this is your first episode listening, welcome. If you are a loyal listener, thank you so much for tuning in once again. Hope we have another good one you are going to absolutely love. So last week we had Siri Lindley, and what an episode that was. One of my biggest heroes, and she had some incredible words of wisdom for us all about how to overcome our obstacles and become the best athletes we can be. Did you listen to the podcast episode we talked about in that episode with her and Tony Robbins yet? Absolutely amazing. And now, hopefully, if you have, you see why I've listened to that episode three times already. Everyone I've spoken to has listened to this episode with Siri, both the Tony Robbins episode and the one that I recorded with her, has absolutely loved it. And I'm sure you will too, if you haven't already. Today, I have another guest I'm very excited about. Another guest I cannot believe said yes, especially as this guy has gone totally viral in the last few years. His TED Talks have millions of views each. Guy Winch is a licensed psychologist, author, and very in-demand keynote speaker who's a leading advocate for integrating science of emotional health in our daily lives, where we work, education. As with our episode with Meg and Jesse a few weeks ago, I skipped the Running for Real four questions. I know they're fun to answer, but this was such a powerful conversation. I just didn't want it to end, and I had so much more I wanted to ask Guy, so I wanted to make the most of it. I am sorry to Pete and Anne, who are my Patreon supporters, whose questions I didn't get to. And I'm sorry that I didn't get my questions answered because I had so much more I wanted to know. But let's get to thanking our friends at Mercury Mile and Body Health for sponsoring this episode, and then we'll get right to it. Thank you to Mercury Mile for supporting this episode of the Running for Real podcast. If you are like me and terrible at picking out running clothes that go with one another, or even trying out new running brands at all, Mercury Mile has you covered. After you fill out an online survey, which is really fun itself, they'll mail you a box with an outfit that matches your size, style, and personality. What you love, you keep. What you don't, you send back. It's that simple, and I love it. I'll tell you more about it later in the episode. Thank you to Body Health for sponsoring this episode of the Running for Real podcast. I am so thankful to Body Health and their support, not just of this podcast, but of me through their Perfect Amino products. They help me recover faster and feel better. You too can get 10% off at bodyhealth.com using code TINA10. Guy, thank you so much for being here with me on the Running for Real podcast. I am really excited to talk to you today, and I appreciate your time.
I am very honored to be on, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be great. And I mentioned to you just before we started recording that I've been listening to your book on Audible, Emotional First Aid, and I've been really enjoying it. And it's really kind of making me think. I absolutely love the layout. So for listeners, the way Guy laid it out is kind of taking this to be, as you would imagine, a first aid book, but rather emotional issues and psychological things that we deal with, giving you, you know, symptoms you might experience, a treatment summary, how to go about the different treatments, how long to administer them, when to administer them. Really, really interesting. And first, maybe in your own words, as you obviously know this book better than anyone else, if you could tell us about emotional first aid and then maybe even what led you to this point.
Yes, I'm happy to. So, you know, the thing about emotional first aid is when I had the idea for a book, I was reading a lot of research about very common emotional injuries or emotional experiences that we have in daily life, like when we get rejected, when we fail, when we're ruminating, when our self-esteem is at a low point. And there's a lot of research about what one can do about those things and what one should do about those things and about what those things actually do to us on a conscious and unconscious and performance level. And I struck me that, well, you know, that there should be some kind of book about emotional first aid, much like there is about physical first aid, where people can know how to dress these kinds of wounds and address them rather than neglect them. But I was absolutely convinced, well, there's got to be something like that out there, obviously. And then I looked and I was like, oh my goodness, there's not. So then I thought, well, then I will do it. And so the idea was to have a list of the seven topics I cover in the book. And I really cover them in two ways. First, I want people to understand, well, what happens to you when you experience, say, rejection or when you fail at reaching a certain goal? What are the psychological things that happen to you beyond the ones that you obviously know? You know it's demoralizing and disappointing, but the things that happen are beyond that. So, A, what happens to you so you can understand what happens to you, understand the universality of it. And B, here are what the research is pointing at in terms of what we might do to recover more quickly, to soothe emotional pain, to get over it and to bounce back more quickly. And so that's how I kind of laid out the book. Seven topics, and with each topic there's that specific breakdown.
Mm-hmm. And was this before or after the first TED Talk that you did? Was this something that kind of came about, people saying, you've got to write a book, or was this, you know, long before that?
So that preceded my first TED Talk. After I wrote the book, I was thinking that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people think like, oh, I could probably do this in a TED Talk. And I, you know, I found that I was actually going to be in Sweden because the book was coming out in Swedish. And I found a TEDx conference. TEDx conferences are conferences that are licensed from TED. They're not by TED, but the university ones and other places that license the format. And I applied to do the talk and I did it there. But I wrote the talk, the Emotional First Aid TED Talk, with the idea that if it's going to be a TEDx, it's going to go up on the YouTube TEDx channel, and there are many that go up there. They have probably 300,000-400,000 of them. But my idea was, if people from TED, from actual TED, saw it, they would think it would be one of those that should go on their website, because they sometimes take some TEDx talks to put on their website, and that's what happened. They saw it on the YouTube, they put it on their website, and when it went on their website, it went viral very, very quickly. It amassed a million views in probably a couple of weeks. And then from there, I wrote articles for them, and then they asked me to write a TED book for them and give an actual TED talk on the main stage TED, which I did last year, and that was called How to Fix a Broken Heart.
Yes, yes, and that is also the name of another of your books. I will put links in the show notes to everything that we talk about today, just for the listeners to know. And so, okay, let's talk about like emotional first aid, or just dealing with these kind of psychological issues that we're struggling with. For people who are listening and thinking, oh, it's just exhausting to deal with this. Why do we have to kind of address this stuff? Why can't I just keep on ignoring it and just pretending, carrying on with my life?
So this is a runner's podcast, and I will say, if you get a certain nagging slight twinge or an injury, you can say to yourself, oh, why can't I just do that? Because I can keep running right now. But if you do, the injury will become worse. That's not always the case with emotional injuries, number one. And number two, there's something you can do that will help you recover more quickly from that emotional wound, that will soothe the emotional pain, that will kind of make sure that it doesn't fester or become something worse. Why wouldn't you want to do something about it? In other words, I'll say it this way. We all have a finite amount of both intellectual and emotional resources that we allocate on a daily basis. When you're preoccupied with something that's nagging at you psychologically or emotionally, by definition means there is less you have left over to be putting toward what really matters to you, your work, your career, your training. And so you really need to free up that bandwidth. You don't want to be preoccupied. We know, for example, that when people, you know, are dealing with feelings of guilt or they're feeling depressed, that can take off something, an IQ points in that, in those days, because, you know, we're not be putting all our effort. There's this, back of our mind churning that goes on. So it really takes away from our ability to perform to a peak when we have neglected emotional wounds, and when there are things that are preoccupying us on the psychological and emotional level, behoove us to really address them and get them, fixed as much as quickly as we can, so that we can really be fully dedicated to what matters.
Yes, that's a great way of looking at it. And I think it's great that you actually have runners here who can kind of get the analogy, and it you can very much put it in that sense that we can understand. And then what about, it's funny that you compare this to the kind of physical side of things, the physical treatments that we give, but we've very much become a society where taking medication and, sticking a Band-Aid on, kind of taking quick fixes, is kind of the way that we deal with things. So, even further with this, we would rather than dealing with kind of the source of our physical pain, we would rather just take, some ibuprofen to get the pain to go away. What about for these emotional issues? If people are kind of saying, oh, that's, a big Pandora's box. Like, once you open it, I'm really going to have to kind of work through some stuff, and I'm not sure I'm ready to do that. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, look, I'm not the kind of psychologist that if you come in and you say, I want to talk about, I'm having trouble reaching this goal in my career, whether it's as an athlete or, in your work as an athlete, that my first question will be, well, oh, great, tell me about your mother. That's not, that deep excavation stuff, I think it's great for some people some of the time. It's not really what I'm about most of the time, because really you're not Pandora's box. And by the way, you might be if you're the kind of who really doesn't think about their emotions, who really doesn't introspect much, who doesn't self-reflect much, who doesn't ask themselves questions about, why am I feeling this way? Or what is this about, perhaps? If you're the kind of person who just doesn't do that, or the kind of person, and the people that say this to me all the time, I don't really believe in feelings, some people say to me, as if they're like unicorns or aliens, that without real proof, how do we know they exist? Kind of thing. If you're the kind of person who doesn't believe in feelings, perhaps looking even just on the surface of them might be Pandora's box for you. But I believe in a very specific kind of examination of that. We're looking at specifically what happened in a specific instance, in a specific context. I'm not saying you need to do this great excavation of your childhood and of all your underlying issues. And, and again, the analogy of emotional first aid is, it's emotional first aid. It's not emotional brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
That's and true. So the idea is, let's deal with the specific injury in a specific area, in a specific context, and move on. And in emotional first aid and in that kind of work, that's what I'm advocating. It's not a let's open Pandora's box and delve into your deepest psyche. That's certainly not something you can do in a self-help book, nor in an individual session. And it's not something that I'm advocating.
Mm-hmm. No, and that definitely comes across in the book. I absolutely love that it was very much kind of a case, like in a first aid kit, you can just kind of go along and say, okay, I'm kind of struggling with, not being able to forgive myself. And then here is, what the section you can go to, the chapter you can go to. So I appreciate you explaining that, just because I know that's what a lot of people will come to if they do kind of, find it difficult to kind of address things that might be going on, even if they are thinking about them a lot. So when I reached out to you, you told me that you mostly say no to interviews, but you did say yes to this one. Now, you run a little yourself, but what is it about, was it the running itself that caught your eye? What is it about this podcast that kind of made you think, actually, this would be a good audience to talk to?
Okay, so first of all, I love running. It's my favorite sport as a participant and as observer. I've only actually attended the Olympic Games, as a spectator once when they were in London. And the only events I went to were the track and field events and the running events.
The best ones.
So number one, it's my favorite sport. So that did it. And I have an identical twin. I talk about him in that first TED talk that you mentioned about emotional first aid. And running has figured very prominently in his life as well. And so for that reason, it was like, oh, well, it's running. And also you're a marathon runner. I mean, that's just just too up my alley to, you know, it hits all my buttons. So I'm like, I'll definitely have to do this one.
Yes. And I would love to go into kind of, you mentioned there about your twin brother, and it goes beyond just him enjoying running for what it is. Tell us about what happened with your brother when it comes to running when he was battling cancer.
So yeah, this is a little bit of a spoiler from the TED talk, but he's my identical twin, and we've always been very, very close. And then he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and given, you know, 5 to 10 years to live or something like that. And he, you know, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he never ran. He was a dad of 2 young kids. He would once every couple of weeks go and play basketball for, you know, like 30 minutes or something. That was the extent of his athletic endeavors. And when he got diagnosed, he had tumors all over his body, lymph nodes, etc. And they had this, wait and watch and wait approach that, you know, we'll start chemo when the tumors get big enough. And so he had to wait, and the waiting was terrible, you know, in that situation. So he figured, you know, I need to get healthy. If I can get my body more healthy, then, you know, maybe that will help things. And he decided, you know, I'm going to run. And when we were kids, we would look at, we'd always watch the Olympics and we'd watch the marathon, and that would be like watching, any of the Marvel or DC superhero movies for us. You know, it seemed like something only superheroes could do. It's not something normal people could do. And so his thought was, I'm going to run a marathon. Now, this is somebody who'd never run before, who was, you know, at that point middle-aged and had cancer all over his body. But that's what his decision was. And he decided, well, if I'm going to do it, the marathon I want to run is the Athens marathon. That's the original one. So he signed up for the Athens marathon, and he started like 9 months of training to go from, you know, zero to marathon. And he wasn't going to, you know, break any records there. He was hoping to finish. And in doing that, in the training, he was extraordinarily dedicated and really followed the training, you know, and it was his purpose. And he kind of felt, if I can prove to myself that I can run a marathon, maybe I'm not dying right now. And so there was so much on the line for him with this marathon. And then he and his wife flew to Athens, and they arrived on, I think, a Friday. The marathon was on a Sunday. And they lost his luggage. And in the luggage were, other than the running shoes, which thankfully he had on him, was everything. You know, the breakfast, the gels, the, you know, everything, you know, the shorts, the, everything he would need for the marathon. Mm-hmm. And so there he was. He didn't have anything. And the hotel felt so bad for him. And they told him they're not going to get the luggage in time. So he had to spend the day before running around Athens shopping for everything. And the hotel felt so bad. They said, look, we want to try and give you a perk. And the only perk we can give you is to give you a pass to be with the elite runners.
Oh, cool.
And so there were 5,000 people in that marathon. There were however many buses. And my sister-in-law has this all on video. You see the day of the marathon, the elite runners bus arrives and the doors open and the athletes come out. And it's basically Kenyan, Ethiopian, middle-aged white guy, Kenyan, Ethiopian. And everyone is looking at him. All the elite runners are looking at him like, who is he? We're not familiar. Is he ranked? Like, where did he come from?
That's funny.
So they were really trying to wrap their head around, who is this person who's with us? But it was a great gesture. And he was able to finish. And, you know, his time, I think, was 4 hours and something. But he was able to finish. And when he finished, you know, you can see in the video, he crosses the finish line and just bursts into tears because it was so symbolic for him. And this was 14 years ago. And so he's still alive. He's still well. He still runs. He's done 5 marathons. And it's he attributes running to the thing that's kept him alive.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And thank you to him for allowing you to share it. And I'd imagine that kind of whole journey to getting there showed him that he felt that his body was kind of not failing him, but it was kind of having a hard time. And being able to do this was him kind of taking back that control and saying, you know, my body's stronger than I thought it was, or it thought it was, and it can get through this stuff. Do you think there was any part of that with that?
I think it was, I don't think so. That's what he would talk about all the time. He would say, my body is incredibly strong. My body can run marathons. Therefore, my body can beat cancer, and therefore my body can really survive. And I'll tell you one other thing that was incredibly useful. He had regular blood tests, right, because he was being monitored all the time. And there were times the blood test came back poorly, and his doctor said, I think we need to start chemo now. And he literally said to her, no, we don't, because I can tell with my running that my times aren't dropping. And if my body were really going into that state where we needed to start chemo, I would see a difference in the training. And if I'm not seeing a difference in the training, I want to redo the tests. And then they redo the test, and it turns out he was right. They were abnormal. They came back normal the second time. Wow. So he could actually tell, based on the performance of his body, what was going on internally with these tumors. It was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. And that must have been so good for you to see as well. And when you said about, you've always enjoyed watching running, even growing up, the two of you did, and then you went to the Olympics in 2012 and things like that. You know, did he share that same passion for you? Did he enjoy running, or was it kind of brought into his mind just when this was going on?
We enjoyed it both extremely as spectators. It never occurred to him to actually be a runner until he got cancer and decided to do the Athens Marathon. So he had not run beforehand, and neither had I. And that's when we both kind of started to run. You know, I had a little bit less of the motivation and the purpose behind me because I didn't have cancer. I also live in New York, and the weather makes it really difficult to do a lot of the year. But that's when he started. He really started late in life and discovered it late in life, got his wife to start running, got his family to start running. I mean, in other words, it spread in the family, and he spread that to many other people, the joy of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I know in the book, you also talked about cardiovascular exercise can be something to kind of deal with things that you have going on. I think it was rumination that you talked about in particular. So tell us about kind of the mind aspect of this. How does running help us mentally?
So there's research on antidepressants, say, and the benefits of an antidepressant compared to cardiovascular exercise that you do for at least 30 to 40 minutes at a certain rate, let's say, four or five times a week. And you will see that the benefits of the cardiovascular exercise are often very equal to the benefits of antidepressants, with one exception. The efficacy of antidepressants begins to fade often after a few years. The efficacy of the cardiovascular exercise does not. So one of the first things I always recommend to people struggling with any kind of depression or anxiety or mood disorder is to adopt cardiovascular exercise. And again, going to the gym for 20 minutes once a week won't do it. As people probably listen to this podcast know, you really have to be a little bit more dedicated. 30 to 40 minutes of a certain heart rate, four or five times a week, really has very strong proven benefits for mental health. Mm-hmm. And so, if you don't like medication, if you don't want to do other things, just do that.
Mm-hmm. And for someone listening who might have someone they care about who is maybe struggling with something, they think this will be a good thing for them to do, but the person they're talking to is kind of like, I don't want to run. I'm not a runner. I that's not going to work for me. Any suggestions in your experience with kind of getting people to actually give it a try?
Well, I say cardiovascular exercise. So if it's not running, then try biking, try swimming, try, any kind of sport in which you're really engaging in cardiovascular exercise, getting your heart rate up to a certain level and maintaining it there for a certain amount of time. And, find the sport that works best for you, but find one.
Yeah.
Rowing, whatever it is,
Yep. Okay, great. All right. I would love to talk about social sharing or social media. You kind of focused a bit on this about this in Emotional First Aid. And particularly what caught my eye was you talked about a study about overcoming trauma. And you said about how in this study, they found that people after 9/11 who had been near the scene, correct me if I get any of this wrong, near the scene or close to the scene, who had shared how their experience had been, shared what they'd been through on a Facebook page, struggled more with kind of moving on, essentially, 2 years later, I think it was, than those who, the 25%, I think you mentioned, who did not share their experience. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about, when it comes to social media, we're very much kind of encouraged to share about our struggles or the things that we're going through. I can admit I push people a lot to kind of, you know, talk about what you're going through. It will help. But after reading that, it was maybe it isn't for everyone. So can you kind of share with us your thoughts on maybe trauma, maybe just overall as a whole? What has been your findings with social media and kind of sharing about what you're struggling with?
So that's it's a tricky thing, really, because it's very, very individual. It's individual in this way. When we go through a certain trauma or loss, there are two kinds of people, really. And there are those who really feel the need to share, to talk about it, to really get it out, to process it in that way. And there are those who really feel the need not to. There are those who really feel like, I don't want to talk about it, I just want to move on. And the common wisdom in psychology is, ooh, if you don't talk about it, that's a problem. And it turns out it's not a problem. It's only a problem if you actually want to talk about it, if that's your want, if that's your impulse, and you're not, that might be a problem. But if you're the kind of person who just wants to move on, then it's often better for you to not talk about it. I think I mentioned also I had a couple of patients, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm in New York City. I had plenty of patients that were impacted. I had one patient that died. I had one that was very injured. And when he came out of the hospital and he came to therapy, I didn't know, you know, he came in, sat down and said, I'm okay now. I don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your first impulse as a psychologist is to go, uh-oh. But I knew the research, and the research is if somebody doesn't want to talk about it and gets back to life and is functioning back in life, then that might be best for them. There's research about, you know, when soldiers have trauma, there's this, they used to do this, you know, critical incident debriefing, which for some of them wasn't good because some of them didn't want to debrief. Some of them wanted to just put it aside. Now, not many of us can put it aside and compartmentalize in that way. But for those who can and who want to, it's actually better to do that. For those who cannot or who don't want to, it's not. And they should actually talk about it. So that's one thing to be aware of, that when somebody's going through grief or loss, whether it's you, whether it's people around you, if they say, I don't really want to talk about it. Now, if they say, I don't want to talk about it, and they're, you know, sitting in their room crying and they're not able to leave for a week, that's not good. Mm-hmm. But if they say, I don't want to talk about it, I just want to get on, and they are getting on, then let them be. Then follow that request. Don't urge them to talk about it, number one. Number two, you have to be aware that when you're talking about things, you are, in a way, defining yourself each time, right? You're defining who you are and what your experience is in the world. And when people are trying to overcome trauma, what we know that is most useful, and loss in that way, not just trauma, but loss, is that if you can find a way to gain meaning from it, so that it has it's not just a plot point in your life story, but it's a point from which there is some potential growth to come. It's the point that in hindsight, looking back, that's when you realize the value of really being with family, et cetera, et cetera. That's when you realize the value of slowing down to be more present in your daily life. That's when you realized that the way you were going about things needed to be different. In other words, there was some insight, there was some change, there was some meaning that was derived from it. Now, you can't derive that when you're in that first moments of loss and of trauma. That comes within the steps of recovery. But I'm saying there that the way you talk about things, the way you share things, and again, maybe not in the first few moments, but thereafter, should be, in a way, also an exploration of where is the meaning that I derive here? How do I find a way to place this in my life narrative, mm-hmm. so that there was some kind of growth that I can derive from it, some kind of benefit that can come from this terrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And actually, even on a smaller scale, you know, things that kind of go wrong, if you can find something that, you know, not necessarily a silver lining, but something that you learned from it, it does often help with kind of easing it and, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have not been through too many, you know, serious traumas, but I knew that was something that some of our listeners have struggled with over time, be it grief, be it something happening. And I just wanted to kind of go over that. And, you know, when it comes to, let's just talk a bit more about social media in general. there's all this kind of information coming out now about how damaging it can be. You know, you talked in the book about how essentially lonely we feel within our day-to-day lives. And in your opinion, has social media been kind of a good thing for us overall to feel more connected to more people? Or is it, you did talk about having those meaningful relationships. Kind of talk to us about what your findings have been with regards to kind of social media being the main form of communication most people have nowadays.
So look, it's very interesting with social media. A, it's an evolving medium, and we're evolving how to use it. And we're, you know, there are so many studies going on now about social media and its impact in all kinds of ways. What we know so far, roughly, in broad strokes, is this. It's a tool, and it depends how you use that tool, and it depends when you use that tool. We know that in most social media, if we're talking about Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, whatever, in most of it, what people put forward is their best selves. They're, you know, here are the good vacation photographs. I'm not giving you a picture of how dumpy the hotel room looked, but look, the pool was nice.
Yes.
You know, or here's not, I'm not going to show this video of my child having a meltdown in the parking lot of the supermarket, but here they are smiling in the cart. And so it's highly curated. We all know that in general. Now, when we're feeling bad, we're feeling depressed, we're feeling lonely, we're not feeling good, and we go on and we just surf and just look in a passive way at other people's feeds, then what we see is, well, everyone around us seems to be so happy. Mm-hmm. And we're not. And that will make us feel worse. And people, when they are upset or distressed or sad or depressed or lonely, tend to be more passive. They tend to, you know, they're not up for much. And so they just, you know, with their fingers, they keep like scrolling past and everyone's smiling and everyone's together and everyone's this and everyone's that. And it makes us feel much worse. And so it's the passive use in times of emotional distress that is problematic. What we also know is that active use is much less problematic. In other words, if when you're feeling isolated or lonely, you're going on and you are looking at your friend's post, say, but you're not just liking, you're commenting, oh, wow, you know, that looks like you had such a great time, and I hope to see you soon, I miss you, that kind of thing. Or you post something that is like, oh, sitting here remembering the time that we did, blah, 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 you know, that allows you to engage with other people in a more active way, you know, and it's limited how much you can do that on social media, but in a more active way, then we tend to not feel that bad. And so if you're using social media to engage with people, then it can be useful when you're feeling bad. If you're just using it to observe the fabulous lives of everyone around you but you, it'll probably make you feel worse. So that's one thing. Second thing is, we often can use it as a crutch. So that I don't need to call Sally or Dan or Howie because I can see what they're up to. So I don't really need to call them and say, hey, what's going on? Let's catch up. And so it can take away a little bit the need to have more direct contact, even if it's by phone, even if not in person. And that's something we need to be, you know, aware of, that it's not a substitute for in-person contact, that we shouldn't rely on Facebook or Instagram or whatever the social media medium is, and to therefore feel like, oh, we don't need to reach out, we don't need to connect in a more personal way, because that's what's making us feel lonely and disconnected and isolated, that, you know, other people's lives are like stories and movies that we're viewing and watching, but we're not really participating sufficiently in. So the reaching out part is really important. And I do want to just say one thing here, that when we're feeling lonely, specifically, we have to be very careful about how we reach out. Because when we're feeling lonely, we're feeling very raw emotionally. Mm-hmm. And we're probably feeling neglected by our friends. And we're probably feeling that our friends don't really care enough about us. And so the way we might reach out might be a bit of a miss in terms of coming across as a little too resentful or self-deprecating, like, oh, I know you're too busy for me, but I wanted to see if that's not a good opening. Mm. Or why haven't you called me is not a good opening. And so we need to reach out in a way that's actually inviting. And here, I there's something really stupid that I believe in, but I think it's very, very useful. And that's emoticons. Yeah. Because add a smiley face to the end of it. And if there's a question, if that can be read a certain, because you might intend it to read a certain way, but it can be read a different way by the other person. So, oh, I haven't seen you in 2 months. You're thinking in your head, you're saying it with a smiley kind of lilt in your voice, but they're reading it as, I haven't seen you in 2 months. So add a smiley face and make it a positive reach out. Make it inviting to the other person. You know, oh my goodness, I miss you. We must have coffee soon. When are you free? It's much better than, I'm sure you don't have time, but if you do, maybe we can perhaps meet for coffee. No. So the be when you're reaching out and you're feeling lonely, be careful. Use the electronic communication to read it over. Add, you know, smiley faces, whatever the emoticons are, to make it inviting for the other person. You're much more likely to get a positive response if you do that.
Absolutely. Oh, everything you said there is so good. And I mean, I definitely recognize parts of myself in each of that, be it, you know, kind of when I'm feeling a bit down, what do I end up doing? Scrolling, but never actually liking anything or commenting on anything, because I'm kind of like exactly what you said. And with your second point about kind of myself, I definitely struggle with that with my friends in particular. My close friends will say, oh, well, I know everything that's going on with you. And I'm like, I don't know anything about what's going on with you, because, you know, I obviously put all my stuff on social media and people read it. But and then I might make some kind of, you know, maybe it's slightly aggressive remark, like you mentioned there about kind of not speaking to them. And one way for me I found quite helpful is maybe either like taking a photo of something either they bought for me or something that reminds me of them, or like playing a little clip of a song or something that is kind of brings a positive memory back and might kind of, you know, remind them that I'm saying this in a positive way. And I've been trying to help myself do that rather than being like you said, I know you're really busy right now, but when you have time for me, I'd love to chat, kind of thing. So thank you for mentioning that, because I'm sure everyone listening in some way kind of resonates with a lot of that. And okay, so I want to move on now. Just when it comes to let's talk about conflict for just a second there. You know, a lot of this in the book is kind of talking about wanting to kind of resolve things that are bothering you. And maybe you need to address it with someone in your life who is important to you. But something that, you know, I know that I struggle with, and I know a lot of other people struggle with it because they've mentioned it to me in the past, is maybe you want to resolve something with someone, be it a friend, be it a family member, but that person kind of shuts you down and says, I don't want to talk about this right now. I just need to move on. So we talked earlier about the kind of person who says, I just want to get on with my life. But what if the person on the other side is someone who does need to talk about it? How do you kind of get around, you know, when one person thinks one way and one person thinks another way with how they deal with struggles?
Well, okay, but you're actually referring to an interpersonal conflict, right? In other words, is that what you're asking about? Like, so two people have a conflict, one of them wants to talk about it and the other one doesn't.
Yes, yes.
And I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of which person are you asking?
Probably the person who wants to resolve something.
So look, when there isn't a thing, something there that needs resolution, that's bugging you, that's bothering you about, you know, that happened with someone, and you bring it up to them and say, look, this is something that's bothering me, I wanted to talk about it. And the other person says to you, well, I don't. Mm-hmm. Or they'll give you 5 minutes and they say, you know what, I really don't want to talk about this. It's a very aggressive statement, I think, to say to somebody who's a friend or a family member, a colleague, whatever, I know there's something that's bothering you, but I don't want to talk about it, so just deal. It's a kind of hostile statement, if you really think about it. And so, you know, the questions that come up to me are like, well, how did you bring it up to them? Perhaps you brought it up in a way that's too accusatory. Mm. Sometimes we have we keep things in, or we accumulate, and then it's not, oh, this thing bothered me. It's, this thing you did bothered me, but the other thing bothered me, and the other thing bothered me. And in fact, you've been doing this for 10 years. And then the other person's like, whew, that's a lot. So, and then feel like, you know, and I don't feel like having a, you know, complete, you know, obviously you've been thinking about this for a long time. I have not, you know, my first question is always, how did you bring it up? What did you bring up? And what I say to people is this, when there's something that's bothering you with someone, and this actually refers to my first book, is called The Squeaky Wheel. It's about the psychology of complaining. And from that, I want to mention a couple of things. Number one, when you have a problem with someone, the first question you have to ask yourself, if you want to talk to them, is what do I want to get out of that? What am I looking for? And it's going to be a friend, it's going to be a spouse, it's going to be a partner, it's going to be a family member, whomever. What am I looking to get here? Am I looking for an apology? Am I looking for them just to hear me out and validate that I was upset? Am I asking for them to make it up to me in some kind of way, to promise me it will never happen again? What am I actually after? And when I ask people that, a lot of times they'll say, I don't know. In other words, it bothered me, so I wanted to bring it up, but they didn't take the time to figure out to what end. Mm-hmm. If it's just to inform the other person, then you need to bring it up a very certain way. And if it's because you want something, then you need to bring it up a different way. And if it's you want them to change their behavior going forward, you need to bring it up a third way. And so what you want to get out of it really should inform how you bring it up, number one. Number two, people can absorb one issue at a time. Let's say somebody was late and that really annoyed you. And it's a spouse, right? Mm-hmm. If you're starting with, you know, when we met in 2003, you were late then, and you don't have to take a running start from 2003. Because if your point is the lateness is a problem, just use the most recent incident. It's much easier for the other person to hear. It's much less overwhelming, number one. Number two, I always suggest a sandwich recipe, the complaint sandwich, I call it, where you start with something positive and end with something positive. And, you know, so the first slice of bread has to be positive in that sandwich, because otherwise the person's going to get defensive and you want them to keep their ears open. So you start with, look, our friendship's really important to me. Or look, I really enjoy running with you. Mm-hmm. Something positive. And then the complaint. And the complaint is the meat of the sandwich, and it needs to be lean, as specific, short, and crisp as possible, because that's clearest. But you always seem to do this and this and this. But last time you were late and it made me unable to do the run that I wanted. Or you then go and bring in a friend without letting me know, and it just feels different when they're running the two of us versus there's a person there that I don't know. You know, just very specifically what happened. And then you end with something positive to incentivize them, to let them know that, you know, what it is you want. And so in the future, if it just us going running, I'd really appreciate it if you, just us. And if you wanted to bring someone, please check with me first. If you phrase it in that way, it's much easier for the other person to say, okay, I'll get it, I'll do that. As opposed to, you don't know how annoyed I was, you brought someone, and it's not the first time you've done that, and it's so annoying. And what is the other person supposed to say? It's like, you know, like it's just much harder to respond to. So these things about bringing up issues we have with another person, they actually warrant a little bit of thought planning in terms of what we want to achieve and what's the best way to do it. Okay. Now, we want to clear up one last thing here. It is much more satisfying to blast them with all the resentment you've had about it for however long. It is more satisfying. It's just much less effective. So you have to make a judgment. Do I want to vent and be satisfied, or do I want to get the results that I want? And if it's about getting the result you want, then you need to put aside some of that visceral joy of blasting the other person when you think you're right, and do it in a way that's more strategic but more likely to get you what you want.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much. That's really helpful, because I think that's very much that whole, was it the battle of the or the war kind of thing. So I appreciate you sharing that. All right, let's run through a few runner scenarios that people might go through and maybe struggle with. Let's start with when you're injured. You know, we talked about grief and trauma earlier briefly, but it can feel a bit like that, like you've lost someone, especially when someone has been, you know, training hard, they've given up a lot within their social life and their, you know, emotional health, everything. They really have given up and suddenly got injured, but feel a bit silly for feeling that way, particularly when talking to non-runners who kind of say, just get on with it. What would be your advice for people who do kind of feel that real sense of almost depression when an injury strikes or maybe a bad race happens?
Okay, well, those are different things. Okay. Because here's the thing with the injury. When the injury, it means you're sidelined for a bit. And hopefully not too long, but it means you're sidelined for a bit. And what's difficult for runners there is that, you know, running is a big part of your identity.
Yeah,
it's a part of what defines you. It's a part of, it makes you feel like you. And then you don't get to do it for however long. And that's very difficult. It's like anyone who has a passion and you take away their passion, they're going to feel a significant loss, even if it's temporary. And so it's not just the identity part. It's a social thing. It's a, you know, the cardiovascular benefits of it. It's these goals that you've been training toward. Most runners are training with certain goals in mind that now get delayed, postponed, or shelved entirely. So there's something extremely demoralizing about it. So, you know, if non-athletes don't understand why that's a big deal, you can either explain it to them or perhaps not even expect them to, but you can explain it to them and say, well, if you were working towards a promotion for a whole year, and a month before the promotion, your boss was going to give it to you or not, move to another company, and now you have to start spending another whole year impressing the new boss, you'd feel really set back and demoralized by that. It's kind of like that. You know, you'll try and find an analogy in someone's life that they might actually be able to understand. Something was taken away here. There's a loss, and it's frustrating. Now, those are very difficult, frustrating moments. And dealing with injury, and really the best way to do it, is to, you know, A, accept that, okay, injuries happen, and then be as diligent as possible on the recovery, on the physical therapy, whatever needs to be done in order to recover, to strengthen, to fortify whatever it was that got injured as much as possible, so that from going from a weak thing, you can make it a strong thing as much as possible, right? When when a race happens and you don't get the result that you want, I have this attitude about it. This is my bias. It can be very annoying for some people. But here's my bias. I think it's a 1-2 combination. I think you get to feel really bad for a limited amount of time. In any disappointment in life, for anything, for anyone, you get to feel really bad. You get to feel disappointed and resentful and upset and curse the fates and, you know, and shake your fist at the heavens. But give yourself a reasonable amount of time to do it. And by reasonable, I mean, if it's not a huge race, give yourself an hour. And if it's a big one, give yourself perhaps a day. And if it was the Olympics, give yourself maybe a week. But that's it. And then it's about, all right, now it's my comeback time. So it's about give yourself time to feel bad, but then you have to pivot to the comeback. Then you have to pivot to the, all right, now it's about using that as fuel, as motivation, as now it's about feeding the hunger of now wanting it even more. So you do need to be able to express the bad stuff, the disappointment, all of it, but you can't wallow in it. You shouldn't wallow in it. Give yourself, and I literally, when I'm saying give yourself an hour a day, what have you, I'm being literal. Mm-hmm. Decide, okay, I'm giving myself an hour to feel bad. Decide, okay, I have till tomorrow. I'm going to feel miserable today, maybe get roaring drunk, but tomorrow, new beginning. Like, literally give yourself the cutoff time that you think is reasonable and enjoy the wallowing while you have it, but pivot when that time is up.
I love that. That's really helpful and very distinct so that people can actually put this into practice. And just one other thing related to that, you know, you have a whole chapter on rumination. We've talked about that a few times in this interview so far. For the listeners, I would absolutely recommend this book for so many reasons, but the rumination chapter particularly spoke to me a lot. But you also had a piece of advice, I think it was in maybe the forgiveness chapter, on about writing a letter to yourself. If you are struggling with kind of rumination over a bad race, would writing a letter to yourself, essentially giving yourself a pep talk, be a good idea in this kind of situation? Or what if someone does find themselves ruminating on this race and that, you know, the hard deadline you just said about is passed and it just keeps coming back to, oh, well, if only I had, you know, taken that gel at mile 19, I wouldn't have, you know, blown up 2 miles later. What if they seem to be stuck on it, you know, weeks, months later?
Okay, so right, in all races, you can look back on them. And by the way, you can look back on the ones that went well as well and probably find the areas where you could have maybe done differently and better. But yes, but if it really stings, yeah, the loss, the result you didn't reach and all of that, then yeah, if only I would have taken that gel, if only I would have pushed myself that extra, because once I would have passed that person, I would have been, that motivation would have had me. You can go through it all. And here's, and that is ruminative, because rumination by definition means that you are thinking about something that's distressing in a way that you are no longer gaining any insight from it, any takeaways, any new perspectives that might be useful. It's not a way, it's not you're looking back and making a list of, okay, here's what I need to do differently in my next race. It's like just replaying that moment. Ah, oh, I just stopped. And then you envision having done that and what would have happened. And then you go back to not doing it. And then you envision having done it this way. And here's what rumination does. Every time you have that thought, what you're doing is, and I call that chapter in the book, picking at emotional scabs.
Yes. Because
that's what you're doing. You're picking at the scab. If you think back on a time you had a physical injury, on a time that you pulled a muscle and it was terribly painful, one thing will not happen in that memory. Your muscle will not hurt from thinking about it. Won't happen with physical injuries. If you think back on an emotionally distressing time of any kind, you will begin to feel emotionally distressed. It will reactivate it. You can think back on a time that was really sad, really aggravating, really this or that, and you'll start to feel those feelings. And that's the difference between the emotional and the physical injuries. The emotional ones easily get reactivated, easily. Now, it won't last as long, and hopefully you'll be able to shake it off. But you have to be aware that when you're ruminating, you are making yourself distressed over and over by reliving that moment, by reliving that loss or the disappointment. You are actually putting yourself through it over and over and over again for no good reason. You are flooding your body with stress hormones. You are deepening the emotional connections in your brain between that moment and feelings of loss and, you know, being angry with yourself or being disappointed or being whatever. You're strengthening emotional connections that you actually don't want to strengthen in your brain. You don't want to strengthen connections between something you love and emotional distress. It's not useful. Mm-hmm. And so ruminating can be a very, very damaging emotional, psychological habit. And to the extent that you're thinking back in order to figure out, okay, I need to plan my gels differently, or okay, what can I say to myself in that moment where I was trying to pass and I just gave up? What could I have said to myself? What can I say to myself next time? I want to make a list of things I can say to myself, maybe even remembering this moment. If you are thinking about it in a way that's useful, that's productive, that's going to, you know, that then to the extent you're doing that, great. It doesn't take that long to do. You can probably do that in one or two sittings of thinking through that race. Mm-hmm. And thereafter, it's just damaging. Thereafter, you're just making yourself distressed and upset, and you're making yourself, you know, like really feel the disappointment over and over and over again. You are punishing yourself, both emotionally and psychologically and physically as well, because of all the stress you're releasing in your body. When you go through and think through that race, you're not going to like shake it off and be smiley 5 minutes later. That's going to dour your mood for a while. Mm-hmm. And for what? So you have to be aware that our brain is this magnificent machine that needs adult supervision. Mm-hmm. We can't just let it wander. We can't just let our mind wander and do things on its own that are damaging to us. We have to take over and go, no, not really thinking about that again, because I've already figured out what I need to figure out from it. Here are my list of my takeaways. I'm going to remind myself what they were. They were, plan the gels in this way, tell yourself this and this thing, train for this and da-da-da-da. Whatever they were, you go over that, and then you pivot away from it. And you have to understand that ruminating in that way is just damaging.
Yeah.
There is zero utility at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Zero.
Yeah. And then should you add on kind of some things you did do right to kind of remind yourself of, okay, you didn't do this right and this is what we're going to do next time. But remember, you did get this right and you did get that right. Does that help as well?
Yes. And I think when you're thinking, but that's in terms of thinking about the race rather than the moment.
Okay.
Right? You know, if you're thinking about the race in general and it was all disappointing, I mean, because look, you set the goal to do this, you know, to improve your time. And you didn't improve your time, and you trained 6 months just to be able to improve your time, and you didn't get a best time. And that's terribly, terribly disappointing. It's useful to think about, well, what did I do right in that race, number one? And let me think back to 3 years ago where I would have killed to have this time and how far I've come. So, yes, it's good to put it in perspective. And, you know, yeah, the thing about running is, and especially when you're competitive, no one wins all the time. You need to have a way of dealing with the losses, dealing with the disappointments, that allows you to learn from them what you can and move on as quickly as possible. Yes. Because the one thing about running is there's always another race to look forward to.
Absolutely.
And that's what you should be focusing on.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you so much. That's what I'm always telling people every day almost. All right. Finally, just to wrap up here, one more question. I was hoping to go into this a bit more, but you know, I just want to get one question in about this. With regards to, we just talked about injuries or friends who had a bad race. For someone who maybe had a good race, but one of their good friends did not run well, you had a whole chapter on guilt, which again, another chapter people listening, I would think you absolutely love. But just for someone who, you kind of talked about how we almost end up avoiding people, or people end up avoiding us because of guilt, because we don't want to kind of, for someone in this situation, maybe they had a good race, but they feel bad about, you know, talking about their race, and they don't want to make the other person feel bad because maybe they were injured or maybe they had a bad race themselves. So what would you just like to kind of finish up saying to people if they themselves had a good situation, but their running friend isn't in a good situation, but they don't want to kind of rub it in their face?
Yeah, it's awkward, right? And it also depends a little bit on the person who didn't have a good race, on their level of just general graciousness in the world, because there's some people who don't have a good race and can come up to you and go, I'm so excited for you, that was great, good for you, and be very gracious about it. And there's some that can go, oh, good race, and then go in the corner and sulk, and clearly they don't want to talk to you right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so take your cue from that. So if somebody really looks like they don't want to be around you because they're just feeling bad, give them their space. But get a little distance and then be able to celebrate your win, for goodness sakes. I mean, in other words, you know, these are hard-earned victories when you have them.
Yes.
You should celebrate them. And if it's hard to do, you know, on the bus home because right next to you is the person who had a terrible, terrible race, then go sit somewhere else and text everyone about how thrilled you are. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, you know, have a big yippee when you get out of, you know, range of ear, you know, like of hearing. So, but by all means, do not squash your own celebration and your own joy, because someone, even if you care about them tremendously, didn't have a good race. Because hopefully you're gracious enough that if someone you really care about, you would want them to be able to celebrate their victory.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't want them to be dour or to be, you know, feel bad about doing so well because you didn't do well. That's not right. So, don't put it in their face. But if you want to put it on social media, feel free to put on social media how happy you are. It's up to them to not look at the page because they'll know you'll be doing that. That's their judgment. That's their call. You don't need to think for them. But, you know, like we're talking about how difficult it is to deal with injuries, how difficult it is to deal with failures, with losses. Really, you have to balance that out by, you know, make a meal of the victories.
Yes.
Make a meal of the milestones, because, you know, there are not a ton of them.
No.
Really, I hope you enjoy them. They're hard-earned. Find a way to truly enjoy them and celebrate them. And I know too many people that like, oh yeah, that went well, and off I go, and I'm going to think about my next training.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all right, if it wasn't an important race, that's fine. But if it was, for goodness sakes, give yourself a moment. In the same way I say give yourself a moment to feel bad, certainly give yourself a moment to feel good.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad we ended up on that, because I see that time and time again. People literally finish a race and say, oh, okay, well, I did this, I want to do this now. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's so important. And as you mentioned, PRs or good races are not that common. So we really should celebrate them when they occur.
Absolutely.
All right, Guy, where can people find out more about you? You know, we've talked a lot about your book, Emotional First Aid. You also have How to Heal a Broken Heart. Where can people find you if they want to learn more?
So guywinch.com, that's GUYWINCH.com. My books are in something like 26 languages. You'll have links to where you can buy them in different territories, given the language you're looking for. You'll have links to my TED Talks. You'll have links to my Psychology Today blog, where I have lots and lots of articles, and two other kinds of things that I do that you can follow. And then you'll link to my Facebook. You'll have you can sign up for my newsletter. So everything really would be the place to go.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, for sharing your personal journey and your brother's personal journey. We really appreciate it. And thanks so much for giving us your time today.
It's been my pleasure. And to everyone out there who's a runner, I salute you.
Oh, love that.
Wearing running clothes that are comfortable, stylish, and of course functional can make all the difference in the world. We've all had the experience of wearing something that is clearly not made for function and ending up with chafing so bad you get in the shower and have to stifle your scream. Or is that just me?
I had always seen those personal stylist boxes where you get a stylist who picks the slack up for those of us who are not exactly gifted at choosing an outfit. But there was one problem. They were all for people who, well, look stylish, like they belonged on a TV show in New York. Except I don't wear those clothes, as they may look nice, but just being real, I'm never, okay, really, going to wear them. Activewear, I live in it. Mercury Mile fixed that problem, and all you do is fill out a 10-minute survey all about your style, how loud you would like your clothes to be, your struggles with running clothes, brands you like, brands you don't like. It's a fun survey to fill out, and at the end, your personal stylist will send you a box of running clothes to wear. The items you love, you keep. The items you don't, you send back. And then they charge you for what you kept. It's that simple. Running For Real fans can get $10 off your first box using code TINA10. This is the perfect gift for runners in your life with a reassurance that they're going to love it because running clothes are chosen for them and match for them. Or if this is you, let this part of the podcast play on repeat with your loved one in the room until they get the hint. Go to mercurymile.com and remember to use code TINA10 for $10 off. I love it and you will too. You enjoying these cool mornings? How about the intense workouts that are just as hard as they always were? I don't know about you, but I always feel like workouts are going to be somehow easy in the fall after a hot summer, but they're still, well, hard. I still feel beaten up after hard days and after long runs, and I still get sore the next day, but less sore when I have Body Health Perfect Amino to speed up the recovery process. I take a lot of comfort knowing that it is working hard to repair my muscles as soon as I stop running or strength training. Then I can eat my meal, my usual 25 minutes later to fuel up again. I wish I could say I used that time to stretch, foam roll, do mobility and rehab, but let's be realistic, that doesn't always happen. Usually I'm jumping in the shower and trying to get clothes on before Bailey starts crying or I have to do something else on my list. At least I know Body Health Perfect Amino has my back right from the stop of my watch. If you don't believe me, you can try Body Health Perfect Amino with 100% money back guarantee. So if you don't like it or you can't see a difference, you can get your money back. Use coupon code TINA10 for 10% off everything at bodyhealth.com. And if you aren't a fan of the tablets, they also have Perfect Amino XP powder and there's a new mixed berry flavor to try. Remember, code TINA10 will get you 10% off at bodyhealth.com. My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast, or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really, it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. I know a lot of that wasn't exactly running focused, although as you saw, much of it has running analogies or is somehow tied to running, but I just thought you would love what Guy had to say. Go out and get his book if you haven't already got it. It has really made me think about the way I see things, particularly when it comes to things that I just can't let go of. It's changed my perspective and I'm sure it will change yours. If this episode did speak to you in a powerful way and you are a little concerned with your mental health, the episode on depression with Matt Davis might be worth listening to. That is episode 79 if you want to go back and check it out. There will be links to everything else we talked about in the show notes today at tinamuir.com/episode92. And can I ask you a favor? Can you take a screenshot of this episode, tag me and my guest, and share it to your social media so others know where to find it? You can support me also by supporting me on Patreon. You can buy Guy's book that helps to show him that you appreciate him and you appreciate me. And just any other way that you choose to share this with your running community or any other way, thank you so much. Oh, and if you want to be a part of my pre-launch team for my Overcoming Amenorrhea book, which is coming out in January, send me an email, tina@tinamuir.com, and you'll be able to get the book early and at a discount. I will be telling you more about my book on amenorrhea next week, but for now, I'm going to sign off here and tell you that next week is my makeup episode with Steph Bruce. You know the one I lost, but now she has even more exciting updates for you on what she's been up to with New York City and California International Marathons she has completed. This conversation is well worth the wait, so go subscribe to the Running For Real podcast if you haven't already, and I will see you then. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running For Real podcast. Be sure to check out TinaMuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.